The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
How'd your loan ever got? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like. That's economically viable. No.
All right, Winter Park. You just tune in to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. And a little music there. Anyway, welcome to Punkonomics with your host, Dr. Benny Balick.
Hello. No, I'm on.
Yeah, you're on now.
Hello.
Yep. There we go.
Hello.
Nothing like can't be broadcasting, right?
Yeah.
And our special guest, Corey Carl, and I am Jesse Velez, co-host. And what are we talking about today?
Well, probably a few things. It's kind of, you know, we'll see how it goes. But the official topic, shall we say, is... Because a lot of stuff has happened, but and I have some kind of notes also prepared for my this highly stressful last 5 minute thing.
Oh yeah,
we'll see how that goes. But the official topic is this kind of trick question that I put up there to raise an issue that's crept around. But let's make it explicit and keep going with it. Which is, can you have a, how did I call it? I said, can you have this microphone?
Yeah, we're switching microphones.
Trying to see if there's something in this pile of junk that actually functions.
There's something about organization that, you know.
Oh, you feel better about this arrangement now.
One, if there was a second one.
Ah.
You see what I'm saying? I kind of follow procedure, but.
Okay, Jesse's being a little bit of a, you know, what is it called, I believe, obsessive compulsive disorder?
OCD.
Yeah, OCD.
That's perfectly good. That's right, you know. Frankly, I prefer them than the nasty slobs, you know.
So, true.
The topic.
Worker self-directed enterprises.
Yeah, but the trick question to launch it is that can you have a privately owned market economy that's not capitalist? And it sounds kind of, what? But actually it's important. The name, my students know that I give them a little bit of hell about it all the time, this whole capitalist. First of all, I like to ask them, do you have $1 million? No? Then you're not a capitalist. Shut up. Because that's roughly how much money you have to be, you know. The second thing is that capitalist, right? It has an ist in it, which implies that you believe that a certain segment of the population, in other words, those who have a large pile of money, the wealthy, the very wealthy, shall we say, not the middle class, deserve to be your advocacy, right? When you're saying ist, that's the ist. Is there something weird? Like, is there like a voice in my head?
I hear a voice.
Have I lost it?
Me too.
I'm just wondering.
What is that? Good. I'm glad you brought that up.
Because you were thinking.
Sorry, listeners. I mean, I wish we could have a video camera so you could see like the behind the scenes.
Yeah, a little bit. We should. We'll get around to it, actually. Yeah. We should film it a little bit. And Jesse made a little clip on our YouTube channel.
My phone.
It's not. Is it me? Maybe it's me. No, it doesn't look. Your tablet. As we search
it's
for.
It's coming from over there in the corner.
Where's the voice coming from? It's just that I wonder if there's the weird voice talking in the background in the show. That wouldn't be good.
No, Jesse can hear the show. He's got the feed, right?
Well, who knows?
Yeah, no,
knows?
I mean, we're on the air. So.
I mean, right, given that, you know, my wife from Secret of the Fairies is a descendant from the famous Jeanne d'Arc, you know, and she was famous for hearing voices, so I was wondering if it... No, I still hear it.
Yeah.
It's the phone. It sounds like somebody talking on the phone or some kind of radio playing.
Maybe it's the monitors outside because we're set on a delay.
Could it be? Oh, right. Well, usually we never hear that.
Oh,
but who knows?
You know,
Dr. Balick.
Rookie mistake. Oh, rookie mistake here. Mistake. I think we might have left the door open.
So Jess is leaving the room to see what's going on. And if not, well, you know.
We're still kind of amateurs here. Like 20...
I mean, but
20 shows in.
I know I'm insane,
we're still working.
You know, that's perfectly right for me to hear voices.
But before we launch into economics, I do want to say it's a depressing day. I mean, you know, it is Memorial Day. I find it depressing. I always get depressed on this day. Whatever country I am, they have different dates, you know, and different styles of commemoration, blah blah blah. But it's always a little depressing, and I always find it a little weird that it's kind of such a cheerful day, you know. Everybody's like, I remember, but then, you know, forget right away. Yeah. So it's the tragedy of it all, you know, the horror. And being a big, as you've probably, anybody who's heard the show, being a very big critic of empire and military, and the use of military, certainly in the long run. It's particularly tragic to think of all this sacrifice, which sadly does not buy us freedom, really. But kills a hell of a lot of kids. So that's very, very sad.
You kind of have to wonder, right? You know, I mean, Vietnam had some pretty obvious consequences for its veterans, right? Lots of homeless.
So did Korea.
All of them. It's amazing, Korea. I mean, a lot of people forget Korea, but Korea was really a very
bloody whitewash war.
Yeah,
Korea. All of them. World War II seems to be this wonderfully heroic, you know, band of... That's simply because that's how Hollywood portrayed it.
Right.
It was horrible. They had PTSD, you know, they had trauma.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They were the same horrors. By the way, I recently posted, I almost hesitated, but I posted, you know, you think GIs back then, there weren't those who went crazy
the ugly way. Right.
Raping, torturing way. Yeah, plenty, you know. Because I think we talked about it sometimes, right? When you put people in the situation, and sometimes you have to. I'm not a pacifist, strictly, you know. Sometimes you have to fight for what you have to fight for. But the price is horrendous, right? Yes. And the people that go there, the vast majority of them, if not all of them, their brains have to deal with it one way or another. And hopefully most of them deal with it with, you know, never really sleeping well again. And some go psycho.
Right.
Because you're sent to do things that a human being is not supposed to do.
It changes.
All of them, you know. We hear those horror stories about, you know, some of them go, you know, to the dark side. It's usually not the majority. You know, definitely not.
Usually the ones that go to the dark side are already been in the dark side.
Maybe they have their tendencies.
Or they've just kind of been waiting for it to...
But the brain has to do something. Either you become a monster and celebrate the violence in some sense.
Sure.
You know, you just embrace it. You basically become a psycho. You abandon your empathy to people. So you're a psycho.
A sociopath.
Yeah, I mean, psycho being not the professional, the popular term. But essentially, if you don't feel the pain of others.
Here's a tidbit. Norman Bates. Mm. Anthony Perkins, one of our alumni.
Oh, really?
Pierre Rollins,
Now that you say it, rings a bell.
Not only did we have Mr. Rogers, but, you know.
I'm more of an Anthony Perkins than Mr. Rogers. Maybe it's a joke. I hope, you know, my good faculty friends here would not appreciate it. Nothing personal. It's just that I know my kids, like, never got it, and I sure haven't, you know. But
Mr. Whatever. Rogers?
Yeah.
You never got it?
No. It's kind of was classified under Barney, you know.
That program.
Not fair, but
that program, when you look at it on today's standards, it's like.
But on the really other hand, today's standards. Oh my God! Right?
I mean,
we've talked about. Well, I know I get confused. Right? We talk about this in Secrets of the Fairies more than on this show,
right.
But we do here too, and just how a psychotic, again, to go back to the psychos of war society in which we live. Again, because if our lives are not human anymore, that is, you know, we are told to live in ways that we haven't evolved to do, you know, and that no philosophy can prescribe, no religion, nothing. It's just it's sick, right? It's a padded room of some kind. Yeah, I know, it's driving me nuts.
This voice is driving all of us.
Just so
nuts.
You know, I will lose it.
Hunt this voice down.
Jesse's going to hunt it down.
Kill it.
It'd be a great prank, I'll tell you what.
Prank someone
at a radio station.
I first thought my phone's like playing a podcast or something, but nope. No, it isn't. Is there another... I don't have any instrumentation anywhere. Oh, maybe there somewhere it's playing the recording. We have an antique PC, steam-powered.
Got it.
Okay.
Right, we're good.
Yeah, it was the computer that records the program.
What really scares me, I mean, you're talking about the horrors of war. I mean, this is what kind of scares me with, like, the problem we have with overpopulation, right? Resource scarcity, massive inequality.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody can kind of read the writing on the wall. I mean, how...
We're in the middle of it.
How
it's
does
not
this
like
result?
It might happen. We're,
no,
we're well
talking,
into it.
I'm talking about a hot war, right? Because humans have become incredibly good at warfare.
Oh, yeah.
We've become incredibly good at killing each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and, you know, if you ever had...
And we are.
If you ever had a world war, right? I mean, it would probably... again, it would probably make World War II look like, you know, patty cakes.
Again, I'm getting worse on you. I'm saying, like, it's going on.
You know, on the other hand, if you look at it from a different point of view, some might say that we haven't gotten that good at all at war. Because if we got that good, then people would not even dare go into war, knowing the amount of...
Well, that's like the mutually assured destruction, right? But, I mean, now what we have...
You have to have rational human beings for that to work, which is a fundamentally wrong assumption.
You also really...
it goes to the whole drone thing, where people are saying they're taking our weapons, but when you walk out of a McDonald's, a drone could be waiting for you.
There's only a couple of countries are able to push the stakes high enough, though, for the mutually assured destruction. I mean, you've got the United States and Russia,
sure.
Right? And then China has significant nuclear capabilities. And now we're really starting... India has significant nuclear capabilities, but they don't have long-range delivery systems. So it's them and Pakistan that kind of have nukes that are opposed to each other.
You also have to include Israel, too, because Israel does not...
Israel has nukes as far as...
boast their weapons or brag about it like
best
we
of, to, and, to yeah, the best
at least 200.
To the best of my knowledge, much though, more. Again, they have like a regional delivery system. But see, the thing is with, like, you know...
India, no, they have a... Didn't they deliver a satellite a few years back? Once you're out of orbit, you can put it anywhere.
It's generally a heavier payload for like a thermonuclear weapon. And I'd be really... I mean, maybe the U.S. gave them thermonuclear
weapons. But the technology
But the thing is like India and Pakistan, that's a check, right?
Right.
The United States and Russia, that's a check. And you could also argue that the United States and Russia... Or the United States and China is a check. Israel has no check, right? Where's the check on them? They don't have anybody pointing nukes back at them.
No. So, well, I mean, that's one of the things that over there, and you guys know, and maybe I should be, you know, for the sake of disclosure, I have some roots there. What's left of them? Rotten roots. I mean, it's one of the, you know, Israel is a long-age joke. You know, where we talk about Israel defending itself and all that. I mean, we're all giggling over there whenever Americans talk about that. I mean, Israel has always fought very easy wars. There was never an existential threat. I'm sorry, you know, if I irritate anybody. I mean, I should think even Israeli patriots would be happy about it. 48 was a turkey shoot. It's different versions
of
turkey
shoots. I mean...
Well, that's pre-Israel.
Oh, okay. Yeah. True.
Yeah. No, Israel has never had an existential situation. We kind of giggle about it over there. It's an army that's big enough to take on any European country, let alone probably altogether. Not because it's so wonderful. In fact,
it's just extremely well.
It's just so
armed.
Big. It has so many tanks, so many planes.
Every citizen is a soldier at some point.
It's giant.
Right. I mean, it's
so the notion that it was a struggle for survival, that there was any real risk for Israel, is a bit fake. It's an extremely powerful country. Of course, now it's panicking about Iran. But again, I got to slip this in. The tragedy of it is that the powers that be, and I know that's a very nebulous term, right? It's not some medieval association, you know. the closest is
the
very powerful people, the people who enjoy tremendous global power, the 400 people who own more than the other 99% on the planet, you know, 99.9999% of the planet, the policymakers, the people who own the governments, if you will. They're doing it. They're making Iran. They're pushing Iran. They're making sure that the crazy mullahs stay in power whenever there's any kind of chance of Iran rejoining, cooperating, make sure
it's
it doesn't happen. But it's divide and suicide, you know. You're the one who raised this issue of, you know, the end game, which is a wonderful way, I think, of looking at it. You know, whatever your ideology, you know, where do you think you're going to... What are you going to do with Iran?
Right.
What? You know, oh, I'm going to nuke him off the face of the earth. Really? You know, and then what? I mean, look at what it's... And to go back, look at the state of the world. We're well into World War III. Let alone if we count the fact that killing people, even with nukes, is not really the big killer. You know, it's starvation.
Yeah.
With disease. We have over a billion people dying now.
Don't sell nukes short. They're capable of...
Sure thing, you know, don't get me wrong, right. I was in Carolina, by the way, invited by my CIA professor. I mean, not secretly so. He did work. He actually had a whole career of doing... when I was in graduate school, he was one of my advisors when I did on comparative systems as a subfield. But he worked for the CIA. He basically, all the 70s, he was coming up with these studies to scare Americans. for the CIA, you know, showing their, oh, look at the Russians, they're pretty efficient after all. Oh, look at the Russians, they could actually produce a lot of tanks after all. Well, frankly, they couldn't, you know, right. They were way too weak in so many ways. But he was in the business of the economists who were scaring Americans against the Russian. I mean, you know, that's another funny story in itself. But there was a conference there.
Interesting side note for our listeners, one of the largest employers of economists in the world is the Central Intelligence Agency.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You
I'm know, not,
they,
you know.
They go everywhere.
Frankly, that's an interesting thing to explore.
They
given
travel,
that these are
meet,
two
and kill people.
I mean, one of the nastiest institutions in human history, along with one of the nastiest disciplines in human history. My God, scum meets scum.
There was
but you know what? There's good and bad behind that whole picture. I mean, if we didn't have people actually taking the risk to find out what our enemies
Yeah, there's a lot of people doing, a lot of CIA people are just doing research.
Research and doing
up.
Good work.
And then their work is being ignored.
By the way,
Wikipedia
is largely, it's an outbranching of the CIA's World Factbook. There's an MIT student
that
back
used
in
to
life.
Be, but when you were still, you know, a young'un, you know, right. The CIA World Factbook was one of the most invaluable resources.
Right.
I remember that as, you know.
Like
so important.
Well, they still update. In 2008, a student at MIT, he wrote a program that I don't know how he did this, but he wrote a program to trace back where all of the Wikipedia edits and entries were coming from. And something like 93% of them came out of Langley, Virginia.
Yeah, but you know, you're right to make the distinction, though. I mean, in fact, a lot of people who are currently yelling and screaming, like, against American foreign policy are ex-CIA people who precisely kind of know how the system works and ask themselves that question. So where are we going with this? So, you know, so, oh, we'll pit this militia against that militia. Okay, great. Then what do you do when they come back and blow you up? You know, then you'll use that as an excuse to pit another militia against another. Where are we going with all of this? And that's, of course, a very big issue. And today we, you know, we remember that so many people are,
well, it's really a turnkey sweater. It doesn't matter what the conflict is. As long as there is a conflict, they keep generating profit.
Bottom line.
Well, the other way, the other way I look at it is you're preventing, you know, comparative buying power from arising. So I call it divide and impoverish rather than divide and conquer.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time I wasn't alive, but I recall reading about this in the 70s. Iran wanted to use its oil wealth to help you know, reconstitute some of the desert regions and turn it into fertile agricultural lands. It was totally feasible, right? But I mean, you just look at it. That's you're taking resources, right, that would otherwise go to the global market, but at the time primarily the U.S. market, oil, right? And rather than letting it hit the U.S. and then having U.S. farmers selling into a robust, you know, grain market, the Iranians were going to use their own oil.
That's 50s already, in 53, when they had a pro-Western economist, democratically elected prime minister come into power, and he was assassinated by the CIA. And after that, and put in his place was a horrific, you know, a butcher who...
it's divide and impoverish. There's a great paper, I've referenced it once on the show before, but you have all of your students read it. It's I don't know if I can say it on the air, but it's the making of a
exploit deleted.
Yeah. I mean, it's the title of a paper though, so I mean, you know, it's not being used in a derogatory sense. And it was a letter written by a British nobleman in like the 1700s, maybe late 1700s, early 1800s, to slave owners in the southeastern United States, talking about how to control the slaves.
Yeah.
And the summary of it goes, it's along the lines of, you pit the young against the old, the strong against the weak, men against the women,
the smart against the dumb. And that what worked?
Do we have a tweet?
No, what now? How the fuck could ruin your summer holiday? You know. Do I have to? Oh, well, later.
I take the same attitude as you. I heard the headline. I was like, really?
Really? Yeah, whatever. You know, I mean, no, it's true, though. I mean, you know, we've had the people talk about it again. I mean, you know, I do like to remind people that everybody's in on it, you know, and the Fed are the servants, you know, they're not the short callers, But again, I mean, a lot of these CIA people were actually yelling and screaming in the early mid-90s about what are we going to do with nuclear technology? To kind of reel back, I don't know, to what we were talking about. Because everybody's going to have it. You know? And they were worried about people like, and I think he should go named because he's really something remarkable, as Donald Rumsfeld. is a little bit like Alan Greenspan of foreign policy. You know, a man whose entire life and long life has always, without exception, been wrong about everything.
Just about.
Never mind what your ideology is. Just wrong, proven stupid. So there, you know, when he was wanting, oh, let's develop, let's put the considerable global dominating, still even today with China, by the way, research abilities of the United States to develop suitcase-sized nuclear weapons. Isn't that a great idea? They were talking about the fact that only a few countries at this point, the ones you were enumerating, have the ability to really develop nuclear technology. But they were saying back in the time that within 10, 15 years, anybody could apply this technology start building stuff.
Rumsfeld is like the McNamara of...
He's no fool, but he's stupid. Many times the things that he says clearly shows intellectual ability. You know, he has the horsepower. But doesn't matter.
But he doesn't make
doesn't
the right decision.
Doesn't have the context, I think. Have the history, maybe, the context. I don't know.
I just want to say...
You want to defend them, go for it.
Clarifying thing, though, about nuclear technology, right? Like the suitcase nukes they were talking about, these aren't the nukes that are going to wipe out a city. These are the nukes that are going to wipe out, like, you know, 10 to 20 square blocks, right? And that's one. And two, you know, the other thing is it's one thing...
It's good enough.
It's one thing to have... to know how to make a nuclear weapon, which, by the way, it's very easy to make a fission bomb. The technology is not complicated. Mm-hmm. If you have a reasonable understanding of, you know, physics...
No, the materials are difficult to find.
They're not even that difficult to find, to be perfect.
Not anymore. That's, yeah.
No, you're getting your hands on uranium is not that hard, mm-hmm. right? That's your starting material.
You have to refine it, though.
That's where it is, and that's where most countries will almost invariably always fall short, and it's because of refining uranium, getting it to weapons grade is...
Yeah, but you can buy it in Pakistan.
It's incredibly energy intensive. All right, so like the United States, when we were running a plant in
Tennessee... Sorry, Pakistan, but, you know, probably the best way place to buy it.
We're running a plant, X-23, it's either X-23 or X-25, in any event, you could Google, it's the largest building in the world still to this date, mm-hmm. right? It was taking down, that refinery plant was taking down 8% of the United States' electrical mm-hmm. production. Mm-hmm. That's massive. That is way out of the realm. And that's just physics. There's no way around it.
But listen, you know, I mean, in all honesty, though, the thing is that I hate to be, as usual, you know, not my perky positive self. But, you know, you don't need much more. Did you see what, you know, what we did as a response? I mean, it's horrible to think. I don't want to put it in the wrong way, but it's really easy to terrorize us, isn't it? Messed up psychos with homemade bombs.
Yeah.
You know, killing horribly a few people in downtown Boston. Yep. And we go on a spin, you know? It throws us off, right? We respond. Look at 9/11, you know, the psychological damage, you know? I mean, then the bankers can, you know, do whatever
they wouldn't even dream of
in terms of damage. You know, how many people die for other reasons from hunger in America today, you know? About a quarter of the population, at least now, is... food insecure, you know? But our response to it is setting the world on fire, abandoning our almost getting friendly with Iran. They were helping us undermine Saddam Hussein. Instead, now let's get multiple nuclear powers running amok in the Middle East. Let's set the world on fire. It's really, talk about irrationality and talk about interests of the American people. Talk about security interests. I mean, if we need to go bomb somebody for security reasons, great. But sadly, well, not great, sadly, but, you know, understandable. But look at the damage done. It goes back to that big economic picture, as far as I'm concerned, too. Nobody's trying to solve the problems. What we do in foreign policy is you have to be really on some drugs to think that what you're doing is making America safer. In fact, you couldn't devise a better way to make America weaker than doing these things, right? So, once again, we have nobody trying to solve our problems. In fact, there's, like you were saying, there's profit in setting the world on fire.
Right. It doesn't make any sense to fix it, because otherwise you're not going to get the request for
In the long run, right? I mean, like, what do you want, Mr. Multi-billionaire weapons dealer? I mean, yeah, I know that this fact that, you know, millions are dying, that the American economy is going down the drain, that the global economy is going down the drain, that America is losing even imperial control over the world, so that basically America can't do anything to even police the world. You could just kill a few civilians in Yemen here and there, but you can't even
At that point, in my opinion, America should follow the lead of all the other imperialist countries, start, you know,
de-imperialize.
De-imperialize.
But I mean, again, it's divided and impoverished. I mean, basically, in my view, by dividing the Middle East, I mean, what you've done is you've prevented the equivalent of, say, like the European Union in the Middle East. We've reduced the buying power. Mm. We've suppressed the buying power of people in the Middle East. They're forced to export our oil to us, right? Mm-hmm. The imports are very appealing to them. Yeah. If they were to cooperate, if they were to have some sort of regional government, right, that was actually functional, you know, if you actually had functional democracies.
Oh, my God.
But no, hang on. They would actually have buying power. That would, in relative terms, it would impoverish us. We wouldn't have as much oil available, right? Yeah. You know. We wouldn't have.
So of course, then we'd economize on that. That we, instead of firing our engineers, you know, we would hire them, and maybe they could actually come up with some alternative technologies and change our way of life, which is killing us, by the way. No, but, you know, aren't we happy to be fat, depressed, drugged out of our minds on legal drugs, driving our great big fat cars to the mall, and getting even more depressed? I mean, we're miserable by any measurable amount, right? I mean, isn't that great? You know.
That's
Aren't we happy?
The American dream.
Yeah, and then we shoot our kids in the schools.
I mean, hey, but we got to keep our guns.
Well, you know, with or without.
Stab more kids in schools.
Yeah, with or without.
We need guns for gophers.
I looked at a stat on that. I mean, you compare school shootings to school stabbings. It's not even in the ballpark.
No. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, people freak out when there's a school shooting, but I mean,
sure.
You know how many kids stab each other in schools every year?
Yeah. Or hang themselves.
I had a friend that went to school down in Miami. He told me he went to like one of the nicest public schools in Miami. Right?
And he
was like, man, this was a good year last year. We only had like 3 or 4 stabbings. So I was like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
Yeah. But so, I mean, again, so, you know, we're driving the lemmings, right? We're like, no, it's not good. It's not doing well. And we seem, I mean, certainly our system is not geared to solve this. Our leadership is corrupt to the core. I think it's time to remind ourselves, because we are an equal opportunity hate program, aren't we? That these are two fallacies that need to be both discarded. The liberal fallacy that, the government needs to solve our problems. I asked them, which government? Because this one sure isn't worth trying.
Right.
And then the libertarians, you know, or their ilk, whatever, you know, conservatives, I don't know what you want to call yourself, you know, settle down, because it's even sillier in some sense to think that, if we only get rid of government because, yes, it is so dysfunctional, so corrupt, who are they being corrupt for? Right? My metaphor is that, you know, from the Westerns, right? I mean, you know, the evil dude with the corrupt sheriff, right? So, yeah, the sheriff, take him down, sure, but don't forget who he's working for. So that's why we need to stop this talk about divide and conquer. I mean, it's the best way to define American politics.
Yeah.
And the gun thing, I mean, you know, we could argue about the nuances of it. I think that there's on both sides some major issues I have. But the issue really is that just stop arguing about that. It's not an issue. You know? Could we control the sales of weapons? Would that make some sense? Yeah. Will it solve our problems? No. You know, will it reduce violence? Probably not. Hardly any. Maybe a little bit.
It's minutia, right?
Yeah. So we don't talk about what's really the catastrophes that we're facing. The literally catastrophes that we're facing.
It's like Nero playing the violin while Rome burns.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's really what's going on, though. I mean, that's really what's going on. And we talk about weapons of mass destruction. Hey, look at the good, you know, very conservative person, though, by today's standards, I guess not anymore, like Warren Buffett, you know, about how he called the financial... Wasn't he the one who called weapons of mass destruction?
He called derivatives weapons of financial mass destruction.
Right. So, you know, when Goldman Sachs
was... By the way, he's not the only one. I mean, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, he made his career in derivatives, right? It's where he made, you know, he's a wealthy man. It's where he made all of his money. He designed derivatives for numerous banks, right? He wrote, basically, it's a tech, if you're a finance student and you study derivatives, you're reading Nassim Taleb's textbook.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally, he wrote the textbook.
Yeah.
He's, you know, brilliant mathematician. And he calls them weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. So to go back to nuclear, I mean, the issue that nuclear is very dramatic indeed and can kill a lot of people, but nothing can kill as many people as starvation.
True.
And we're really good at that. I mean, more people are starving than ever before. It's again, the amount of... And
I think this is acts of war. So here I show certain colors that of my understanding of the economy. There's a struggle going on. And so this divide, impoverish, all these methods that you're mentioning, Corey, are highly criminal and violent. You know, I think I mentioned this in the show before, this notion that, a quarter of Americans are hungry. But they happen to be hungry? No, they were made hungry. They were made hungry by specific policies designed by people who, at the very least, should know the consequences of what they're doing. And these people are politicians, but they are the enablers, they are the lobbyists of industry, of very powerful people who are doing it. So as far as I'm concerned, it's not different than, taking out putting a bunch of people on a train and gassing them. It's the same thing. And I like to remind people, remember how we started talking about Bangladesh, Dhaka?
Right.
When it was like 200, 300? 1,100, close to 1,200 died in that building, And it's just one building. There are thousands of buildings like that. Millions of people are exterminated. I'd like to use that word. All the time for a system that, again, you think, oh my God, I can't afford a more expensive shirt. I buy my clothes at any, by the way, pretty much any. They're all in on it, huh? I don't think we can exclude anybody, except for some hippie hemp T-shirt somewhere.
Right.
But okay. No, not murdering millions of innocent people, in this way, would cost us a quarter more, a couple of bucks. Not even, by the way. Actually, studies show a few cents, 20 cents more on that $12, $15 T-shirt that you buy. What will, however, be curtailed is that $25 million bonus that the executive that deals that puts the guy over there in Dhaka, that tells them to make sure there's no union, because if anybody wants a union, kill them. That guy, he'd still be a millionaire. Yeah. It's fine, I'm fine with that. But he won't be that much. He'll lose a little bit. So that's where it has to go. And it has to go. I mean, too bad. You got enough. Good for you.
Very
enjoy it.
Salient quote from Dwight D. Eisenhower, right? This is, I guess, during World War II. He said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. The world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. I'm sorry, that's actually well post-World War II. That was during the Cold War.
Yeah, but just before he quit on us a little bit. I mean, I always like to say Eisenhower, was a relatively good president, That's a very exclusive club. but it's hard. I mean, I used to, because he said all these wonderful things, and was... I have a harder time being a fan of his as I used to. Because then you look at the detail. When we talk about Mossadegh there, when the Iranians... Yeah. That was under him. Just like people, a lot of the liberals who hate Reagan, and there's ample reason to hate Reagan, one of the biggest criminals of the 20th century. Yes, I had to say it. I think a lot of liberals forget that Carter wasn't Carter, the nice guy, right? Isn't he a charmer, right?
He's got a sweater.
He's got a sweater. He started it. He started this class warfare that basically led to the dismantling of a semi-functioning capitalism that worked here,
But
for a while.
You got to wonder, a guy, to give a statement like that, like Eisenhower's statement, to say something like that, that takes somebody who's thinking deeply, right, and really understands it. So, I can't imagine he's necessarily two-faced. You just have to wonder, how much power does the president really have?
Yeah, that's one of the sides of this discussion that he was kind of, that you're there when you're trying, you're saying, well, already I'm a president, so I'm obviously no radical, right? I'm a moderate kind of by definition. I'm a man of compromise, right?
We're talking about liberals, Eisenhower, not Balak now.
No. Or a lot of liberals who defend Obama along these lines too, by the way. No, it doesn't fly, guys. It doesn't fly at all. I'm done with that. I'm not looking at you, Jesse. but in all honesty, so you get into the position, right? And okay, so I can't get rid of them all, right? I mean, I see these. Let me use words made famous by the previous president, right? I mean, these evil people, and there they are, and they have a lot of power, and I kind of need them because that's our system, But maybe I can push them back a little bit. Okay, so I don't know. So I'm Eisenhower. So I'm Carter, and I'm like, ooh, I'm a good guy, but apparently I have no choice. So I'm gonna send, or Eisenhower,
I'm going to send death squads to destroy democracy in some poor country so that we can exploit them and make sure they stay poor. And I'm going to put, butchers to rule over them, but they do what they're told. And hopefully that'll buy me some time, and then maybe I'm no longer impressed. I really have a hard time. I kind of bite down on my tongue, you know, to say, it doesn't work. You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't. Or does it? It buys us a little time. I mean, we had these wonderful, relatively good 30 years. But then not in Iran, they didn't. In Iran, they had like three. You know? And they went. So in the Western, in the richest part of the Western world, those of us who were white and male and kind of already kind of rich did pretty well. It's not good enough. It's not good enough, you know, is it? It's not, you know? I'm torn. I mean, if you don't get me right, I mean, I'm thinking, so what? So you're going to go gung-ho radical? I have already, I suppose, in some sense. But then am I not just being idealistic, silly, you know? And this was not helpful to just scream blue murder. You have to be moderate. You have to be compromising like that. It's the only way to move forward. I don't buy it anymore. But just because I don't buy it doesn't mean I don't doubt myself, because that's important to do, right?
Yeah.
It's actually critical to do.
Of course, the introspection's critical. Important.
Absolutely.
The introspection's important.
But I wonder about it. You know, we just had dinner with an ex-student of my wife, Tati, would go nameless at this point, you know, but she's from Latin America, you know, and she does forensic anthropology, and she was a moderate girl, and then she's been working on Guatemala. Remember my first 5 minutes? She was working, she was digging up those supposedly terrorists and finding, you know, women with a baby on her back, skeletons in the mass graves, and that kind of radicalized her a little bit. So she hasn't quite swallowed the pill, you know. We discussed it a little bit, and I started getting red in the face, as I often do, especially after eating rather good hot Indian food. But you know, what do you do about it, right? I mean, what do you do? Incidentally, I said that the guy was convicted and kind of blurted a bit of nastiness about Reagan. Though, you know, I have much hate for Reagan, sure, but equal opportunity. I hope I was clear about how even Eisenhower, my so-called favorite American modern age president, you know, generally that's how I used to refer to Eisenhower, or even Carter, the nice guy, deserve. Perhaps not equal hate, you know, if you want to do the calculus of
right.
Dead babies, you know. It's nasty calculus. But still deserve plenty of blame, too. But it's been reversed. So, because the current president of Guatemala, I mean, the brave judges, with the help of the person I had dinner with, I'm very proud of her. Maybe she's hearing this. And she's going to devote her life to doing these kind of things, you know, going to mass graves, you know, and working for the UN or somebody. The current president of Guatemala happens to be the guy who did the murdering for him. Right. Not happens, though. Why did I say happens, right? Not happens to be, because that's how the world looks, right? I mean, that's how most countries are. And indeed, and we are supporting these people. And when I say we, as countries, as systems. Because my planned rant for the last 5 minutes today is a little bit about the fallacy of making change individually, but we'll get to there, right? I'm not supposed to blend.
It's a good segue, though. You know, the system's broken, right? And you had me—you sent me a message on Facebook. Democracyatwork.info.
Yeah. So here's the idea, right? Remember the trick question.
Facebook.
The trick question. Yeah, it is, and I did post a little bit on it. I think with links even, and even a little video clip, kind of 3 minutes, so it's kind of a cute intro to it, so you don't have to, you know, read the complicated stuff necessarily until you find yourself interested. But I urge, especially since I know a lot of kind of libertarian types listen to this show, and I urge you to be, you know, to open your mind to this sort of thing, because that's socialism for Marx, people. Oh yeah, oh yeah. I mentioned that before. This notion that the Soviet Union had very little to do with anything Marx ever thought about, and of course Marx was a long time ago. You know, how relevant is it today? I mean, you really have to do a lot of interpretation to make it relevant. But this notion that you can have a workers-owned companies, and you have them, and they're doing remarkably well relative to others. Right? They do not fire people. Right. The incentives are good. You see, they don't want to cut your health care because they are you. The workers are the managers, right? Workers both work as well as manage as well as own the company. So do they want to outsource your job to third world countries? No, they don't.
Ben and Jerry's, by the way.
Example that comes to mind.
Right, right,
tasty, you know. Tasty example.
The tasty
Ben
example.
And Jerry's.
Yeah, yeah, worker on.
You love
her. Yeah. Yeah, there's more and more. I mean, and actually, there's a lot of little ones, little tiny co-ops. I'm considering, you know, we should start a school.
So, here, there's some questions on the website. They're frequently asked questions. And unfortunately, perhaps it was a slight error in website design. The answers aren't in text format, so I can't read them off my phone. So we're just going to go through the questions real quick. Just blitz through them.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so the first question is, would scarce resources limit worker self-directed enterprises? I'm going to say no. You're going to say.
Well, no.
I mean, they're not going to limit them relative to our existing business models.
You're right. On the contrary, you'd find them to be managed. The interest. Here's another example of the incentives, right? That you live in the community where you work, right? It's your company. You have a stake in it. You have a hold. In some ways, you are a capitalist now because you own capital. And... will you cut costs to give yourself bonuses and dump poison into the river? No, because you live there. So again, you actually will calculate the costs properly and perform the best, as best you can, unlike so many of our industries today who are run by people who have no stake in the communities in which they work. So again, the incentives are actually, look to me, more aligned in the sense of a good market system than what we call today a capitalism, again, because the problem with capitalism is that it is a system in which only one segment and a very small minority of the population, the system is built for them, for the capital. That's ist. I mean, at least, you know, Marx coined the term capitalist as a pejorative term.
Right.
It's kind of funny to hear today people, especially not rich people, calling themselves capitalists. Because that's kind of sad.
It's amazing.
Pathetic comes to
it's
mind.
Amazing how things get lost in history, right?
Oh, man. Oh, man.
It's just like one of those things. Like, apparently, just as a weird historical footnote, the metric measurement for temperature, right? It used to be that boiling was at 0 and freezing was at 100. And then at some point, it just got reversed. I guess it made more sense. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of serendipity and stuff like that, too. Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the questions are, I mean, yeah, let the people go to the website. But, I mean, because, you know, time and all that. Let's look at this for a second. I mean, just the principle of it is that, right, that the people that work in the companies, live in the communities, make decisions, the incentives is the key element here that seem to be, you know, to manage our environment, our costs better. Example like the tar sands, right? That only makes sense because you can extract profit from it because actually it costs more energy or not more, but
there's
it doesn't make sense.
There's been some propaganda on the other
if you
side.
Count the environmental cost of half of Canada looking
on,
like
then,
the moon.
Then it comes down to, like, you know, how do you do the calculations? I used to have to do these calculations, right? I was an environmental sci minor. And then really, when you start to doing those cost benefits, I mean, it's like, how far down the chain do you want to go? So, like, I mean, I can make...
You're supposed to the limit, right?
I can make
mathematically speaking,
I can make the EROEI on anything look negative. Just let me go far enough down the chain. I can make solar look horrible if I go far enough down the chain.
Well, yeah.
So it's kind of... But, I mean, if you're doing it on a fair basis, you know, parts of the tar sands look bad. It also comes down to the quality of the reserve. Parts of it look
and
bad.
And who pays for it? Right, I mean, if you're expropriating people or exposing them to high degrees of poison, etc., because they're poor, that's easy. That's cheap. You're not paying a dime for that.
You know, I mean, I want to go with the equal opportunity thing. I don't want to pick on the tar sands because the reality is, it's not just the tar sands.
True.
It's every bit. It's I mean, it's
true
you know,
that.
Well, the only really easy, nice, friendly oil that's left is in Saudi Arabia and parts of Russia. The rest of it's really nasty. I mean, the stuff we get out in California, right, is nasty. The stuff that comes out of Venezuela is disgusting. You know, there's a huge cost in the tar sands. I mean, somebody coined that term, so I guess we've just, you know, everybody runs with it now. But, I mean, I don't want to pick on the Canadians. If we're going to pick pick on everybody.
And wait a minute. You want me even look at Saudi Arabia. We have to look at what we have to do in that region in order to maintain access to that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to count the millions
cost, right?
that just recently have been killed
that
in that region, right?
So, I mean, the other thing is, you know, I'm just going to finish this tangent real quick, but the tar sands, right? I mean, it's a mining operation. Mm. You're never going to have anything like the Deepwater Horizon. It's not going to happen. So while the oil is theoretically cleaner for the Deepwater Horizon, the potential environmental impact if you have a blowout...
To do the probability,
that's
right.
the tail risk, right? Yeah. And it's an incredibly hostile environment. So, I mean, if I was doing this on a strictly risk, if I had to have oil, and I was doing this on a risk-related basis, I'd go tar sands every time. You know,
If
I'm trying to protect the environment.
That's a good point, right? Yeah. Because of the
kind
of risk.
You have to look at the tail risk.
And we don't manage, and we don't calculate that. I mean, of course,
for a worker-owned system to have an impact on global climate change, you'd have to have somewhat of a critical mass of them operating, but you know, you have to start somewhere.
There's an interesting. You have to start that's somewhere. That's an interesting thing. So I mean, so you have
accountability.
You have worker-owned enterprises. So how do you now? How does that balance? How does a worker-owned enterprise in the tar
and
sands,
managed? It's not just owned. And managed. Of course. Yeah.
How does that in the tar sands? How does that balance with, say, drillers in the Gulf of Mexico? That's where it's worker-owned. I mean, how do you reconcile that? In the context of what I was just saying.
Because I remember your question was about how can we avoid the regulatory, centralized regulatory. And one of the nice things, and that's kind of the what I started with, the appeal to libertarians of this kind of socialism, is the notion that it does not require a lot of government intervention. Right, you do not need the government to tax the wealthy and to police the companies, because private for-profit companies with their managers living far away from where the operation goes and having no accountability would need policing. In fact, any regular worker to some extent needs policing, and one of the arguments that Rick Wolf makes in Democracy at Work .info is estimating how many millions of Americans are employed in supervisory, but not technical supervisory, enforcement, making sure people work hard. Of course, if you own the company, if the success of the company, gave you a bonus and not just a CEO that all he does is hurt you, you would need those people. These people can do productive work instead of police work. So it's even at the core of the police state. And, libertarians are somewhat an anarchist, are red or black or both. I'm not talking about skin color here, right? But politics. Are attuned to that sort of thing. Look at the police state we're living under. Even in America, you'd think it's insane with our constitution, but whatever, constitution, schmostitution, right?
Right.
Doesn't matter. Police come and get you. And frankly, the assault rifles is not what's going to save you from them. Perhaps sadly, but that's the case. So it's at the core, and here you go back to good old Papa Marx, in a sense, at the core of how we work, how we get together. When you go into a wage slavery, and you have a foreman with a whip above your head, and guess what? I mean, the whole society looks like it, like a work camp, increasingly so. So it's an attempt to create better incentive structures that don't require so much control mechanisms, give us more individual freedoms to run our businesses, small, large, medium, whatever.
For the engineers out there, basically what the goal would be is to achieve what's called dynamic stability as opposed to static stability.
Yeah. And if you're drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico, but you live in the Gulf of Mexico.
I like that. I mean, again, I'm a huge Taleb fan. Taleb's thing is like he references Rome. If you're a bridge builder and you built a bridge, you had to sleep under the bridge for at least a few nights. So, you have to actually deal with the consequences. And from an environmental standpoint, I actually very much, that'd be an interesting study, maybe a little project to give your students to see where the CEOs of some of these oil companies live in relative to where the oil is.
I can't think of I was joking with my son Felix the other day. I mean, he was joking with me. We were talking politics while walking the dog he was referring back to the wonderful South Park episode about the Gulf, where you have BP every time, they make an even bigger spill and catastrophe. Eventually, they release Cthulhu, Master of the Dark.
Did you see the shell?
Initially, he's like, "We're sorry."
Did you see?
We're so sorry.
Shell Oil, they did an ad campaign a couple of years ago. It was a terrible idea. The idea was that they were having a contest. They put up pictures of a wildlife in the Arctic, right? And it was a caption contest. Whoever came up with the best caption got $1,000 on a gift card for gasoline or something like that. And it's come up with the best caption for these pictures, right? They're trying to appear to be environmentally responsible. Oh, and people just came in and all they did was only one iceberg left to go. Or another one was a polar bear swimming. It's I got 99 problems, but an iceberg isn't one, And they had to cancel the ad program. It's a massive failure.
Talk in the radical community about this. I mean, right and left, that the people are getting radicalized in the only way that people ever get radicalized. They get kicked out of their houses.
you know, minute before, well, whatever, we'll improvise, right? But I mentioned this before, but there was a settlement because all the banks, especially Bank of America, my bank actually, this is no endorsement, so I don't think I'm violating any rules here because of what I'm going to say next, but they weren't alone. You may have heard a few years back where we found out that they were actually foreclosing on people without documentation, just willy-nilly sending their police, because it's not your police, just in case you're wondering, right? They own it too. Well, they don't own it technically, but the facto.
Right, sure.
So they kick people out of their houses, and with actually people who are paying their bills successfully, which isn't always easy considering all the fraud and the catastrophe and everything. So a lot of our soldiers, right, since we're talking about, it's Memorial Day, right, a lot of our soldiers would be dodging bullets somewhere, you know, and their families were being kicked to the street despite being paying their bills by the banks. And they settled, so they got like 300 or 500 bucks. Some of them maybe even got like 1,500 as compensation.
1,500 bucks.
Oh, the lucky ones, mostly just 300.
That's really sick.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But that's radicalizing people. You know, the thing is that it's important to radicalize people politically as a group, you know, and if we ever manage to have any impact, then we'll probably get into trouble, you know, this show, as well as anybody else. For now, you know, everybody's like laughing, whatever. So we can still talk, I suppose, right? But, you know, you have to, because otherwise people either go nuts.
Right.
We're all under that pressure.
Course.
It's like the soldiers out there who either go to the dark side or suffer deep depressions and damage for life, you know? People are suffering like that, you know? Our kids are committing suicide, you know, the whole bullying culture and stuff. I mean, I heard somebody make a post about, when did the Congress do something about bullying? I wanted to slap them. Give them a little bullying. I mean, what is Congress going to do about bullying, you know? Never mind, but that's another matter. Okay, I mean, that's a perfect segue, actually. So I was reading this kind of progressive person, right? This is now officially my last 5 minutes. Beep, beep, beep. So a proper progressive blogger, and I'm not giving credit, so it's a little bit like, but since I'm not going to be nice, I figure that's a bit better not to, about Monsanto. Now, people should know that millions of people, by some estimates, have been walking all over the world, even here in Orlando, like 150 or something, which for Orlando is a lot. You know, I remember Occupy Orlando was like 300 people. That was pretty exciting. We're marching in the streets, going nuts against Monsanto. And this guy is like going like, basically, you know, it seems that nearly everyone needs a boogeyman, and for many it is Monsanto. So now Monsanto, right, you know, Walmart used to be, right, the hated evil corporation, etc. And again, this guy is supposed to be a progressive, whatever that means anymore, I'm not quite sure. Somewhat less watered down liberal, is that what progressive means? Like, I'd like to embrace the word radical again. Anyway, I don't want to read too much, but first of all, a little bit, you know. I don't believe Monsanto is intentionally poisoning people.
Really?
Despite a lot of the conspiracy theories that claim otherwise. Okay, never mind. Actually, a lot of memos leaked by WikiLeaks. Well, I'll say that in a second. Let me first give him his piece, right? And I'm just reading bits of it. What I do believe is that they are using all means at their disposal to corner the market on food products and seed plants so that we have no other choice than to use their products and on their terms. Go back to what we were talking a minute ago. Here's that sick system, you know? If we owned the food industry, you think we would do this sort of thing to ourselves? Of course we wouldn't. Of course we would. We're not stupid. And they aren't stupid, you know? They are following, at best, he's saying, he's got a point, incentives that are skewed, that make them, capitalism works, market system works well when by doing efficient, productive work, you get rich. If by, you know, eating babies you get rich, then you eat babies, or at least there'll be somebody out there willing to do that job. That thing, you know, if you're not, somebody else will. That's the very ugly mechanism, right? Used a lot by the Nazis. Anyway, so they have a concerning amount of lobbying power over our elected officials, as evidenced by the recently defeated push to require labeling foods with genetically modified ingredients. blah, blah, blah. Like Walmart or any other major corporations, Monsanto want to be the only game in town, and they'll do whatever they have to do in order to achieve that goal, including, you know, poisoning our children. Of course, again, if we were owning that company, we wouldn't poison our own children. Once again, that change in incentives. Now, here's where he goes. So far, he was like, yeah, okay, blah, 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 whatever. Why am I even reading it? Because the title of it was, How Do We Stop Monsanto? It is as easy as this, he says knowingly. And here's the last paragraph. If you want to stop the beast, stop feeding it. Stop buying your food from Walmart and the big box stores. Instead, buy from a local backyard farmer, local co-op, or take the time to fill a pot with some earth and plant some seeds. Grow your own and share with your neighbors. Not only will you do some real damage to Monsanto, but you'll also strengthen your community. And that's the only way to take the monster down. My comment on this was, beep, get real. You know? Why? It's missing everything relevant. It's really annoying the hell out of me. You know, first of all, the history of Monsanto. You know, this is a paradigmatic corporatist firm that uses the government to protect it. Whenever the State Department comes to negotiate with one of those poor countries that Corey would mention before, you know, in the world that need impoverishing and division, Monsanto is there in the room, you know, and we'll take over your agricultural sector, Mexico, most notably. You wonder why a lot of Mexicans have to come here? They don't want to come here. They have to because we have destroyed their food base at home with the help of Monsanto. That's why they come here. I mean, it goes on, but the real point here, first of all, that okay, we have a private corporation whose incentives are skewed against the general public, right? And is big enough and powerful enough to control the government, so that the government actually, instead of policing it in a way that Adam Smith would have understood perfectly well, it in fact becomes its henchman. You know, it's little Gestapo. But the main thing here is this notion that by individual change like that, you know, it's like we'll save the environment by putting up plastic bottles in the blue bin. No, we won't. You know, the mechanism is much bigger than that. What are the options to buy? Are there any clean foods to be got? We even know that organic food is contaminated by these seeds that we know through WikiLeaks memos were designed to contaminate other seeds, not to resist drought, not to be able to be grown better in poor climates, as they claim since the 80s. No, they're designed to destroy everything else. That's what the scientists were getting paid to do by Monsanto, right? So what do you do about it? This notion of individual change is one of the main distinctions between what could be unkindly called a liberal thought and radical thought. And I keep advocating radical. You can't by yourself. You have to organize in groups, all right, to make political change. By being good by yourself, your impact will be at best marginal.
Good note to end on.
Makes sense. I'll buy that.
Because it's a big difference in thought, you know, between radical and liberal.
Okay, well, we're at top of the hour. I'd like to thank everybody out there that's been listening for tuning into Punkonomics here on WPRK Winter Park, Florida. And we'll see you again next week from 4 to 5 with Dr. Benny Ballack. And hopefully Corey will be here too.
Probably. Unless the black helicopters get us.
Exactly. Have a great day and stay tuned for some more great music.
7 years I made music. Nothing I've been asking for long.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.
This is Oliver Stone. Thank you for listening to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. There's no profit in this form of media. Enjoy it while it's still free form.
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. I am John Lydon here of Public Image Limited. You may also know me as Rotten, and I may know you as W.